This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanya.
And I'm Talia.
And we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast.
Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody, to another exciting episode of Crimes and Consequences. This one is especially thrilling because it's a Halloween story.
Awesome.
I get the information from the court order on the case, and that's about the only place I could find this story. So I'm pretty sure that most of our listeners have never heard it. If you haven't done so already, I'd like to ask you to take 1 second to hit the subscribe / follow button on whatever app you're listening to. And with that, I'm ready. Are you ready?
I'm buckled in.
This story is really interesting because it has a few twists, and I love stories with twists.
Me too.
It's not high in the gruesome scale, but it's really interesting. So now I'm just going to shut my mouth. Well, wait, no, I'm not.
Enough with the chit-chat.
Thank you. I'm going to tell the story. On Halloween in 1986, 5-year-old Jenny Gutierrez was just like the other neighborhood kids in Hesperia, California. Excited to dress up in her costume and walk around the neighborhood trick-or-treating. And for those that may remember, Hesperia was the town in which episode 97, Murder in the High Desert, took place, except I called it Hespera. I just want to give a shout out to my Facebook friend that corrected me. It's Hesperia. This year, Jenny and her mother, Rose, and Rose's live-in boyfriend, John, were going to walk around the houses together. It was chilly that Halloween evening in the high desert. The arid air always turned frigid once the sun set. But of course, that never stopped anyone from having fun. Certainly didn't for
never,
me.
Never.
In 86, Halloween fell on a Friday, and Rose agreed that Jenny could stay the night with some of her cousins at her grandma's house. A little before 10 p.m., John and Rose said goodbye to Jenny, and they headed back to the one-story ranch-style house that Rose owned on Mont Rose Avenue. Driving down their street, the couple noticed most of the trick-or-treaters were gone. There were a few teen stragglers wandering around.
That's who always gets my, the end of the candy.
That you just dump it.
Yeah.
Jump it with them. Being both a Friday and Halloween, there were a lot of cars parked along the residential road. So when the couple passed by a van parked slightly down the road from their house, they didn't think twice about it. They had no clue that its occupants had been staking out their house for hours, awaiting their return, with one thing on their mind: murder. They'd already done it once that day, and they were ready for more blood. Rose owned the 1,400 square foot house since it was built 6 years earlier, and together with John, they kept it really well maintained. The landscape was comprised of junipers and Joshua trees, which didn't offer a lot of shade or privacy. After parking John's car in the garage, the couple made their way inside the 3-bedroom home, and John made a beeline for the shower while Rose relaxed on the couch in the living room. Within minutes of their arrival, the doorbell rang. It seemed pretty late for trick-or-treaters, but Rose hesitantly answered the door. Instead of being greeted by kids in costumes, she was ambushed by two men dressed in full Halloween ensembles made of rubber masks, wigs, and long capes. And both of them were brandishing guns.
Oh, great.
How terrifying.
Yes, very.
That's just right out of a movie, right?
Absolutely. I can see it now.
A movie you wouldn't watch.
No, no. I don't watch horror movies.
Which is really ironic.
I know. They're too scary for
me. Stop it. They force their way inside the home, shoving Rose to the ground in the process. During the frenzy, one of the men's masks fell off. And at that moment, Rose knew she and John were doomed.
Oh, shit.
41-year-old Rose met 25-year-old John Stopher a little over a year earlier in June of 1985. Rose was instantly attracted to John's warm nature and his kind heart. He was just really, really nice. The two developed a strong emotional intimacy, and they confided their deepest secrets to each other. It was one of these secrets that would later be used to justify a brutal murder. Rose was still married when she first met John. Her husband, Isaac, who'd been a firefighter most of his life, was in prison at the time. Isaac was an alcoholic, and his drinking cost him his career, his wife, his daughter, and eventually his freedom. In 1983, so this is 3 years prior, Rose kicked him out of the Mount Rose Avenue home, and he was forced to move in with his sister in Bakersfield, California, which is about 2.5 hours north of Hesperia. Now, one night, Isaac got completely shit-faced and decided to drive home from the bar. His erratic driving was spotted by a patrol officer, and a long story short, Isaac ended up leading 6 patrol cars on a high-speed chase.
No.
Yes. Such a dumbass. Some officers that were called in for backup stood on the side of the road and they were shooting at his tires, and Isaac veered towards them in an attempt to run them over.
Oh my God.
And the chase ended after he rammed his vehicle into one of the patrol cars. This melee led to a conviction of assault with a deadly weapon, his car. And he was sentenced to 4 years in prison. So you can see why John would be a breath of fresh air for Rose. By 1985, she'd washed her hands of Isaac and found love with John, who, by the way, doted on 5-year-old Jenny. He took on the role of a father figure for her and just absolutely loved that little girl. In November of 1985, after roughly 5 months of dating, John moved in to the Montrose Avenue house with Rose and Jenny. Rose wrote Isaac in prison, letting him know that she was getting ready to file for divorce. She didn't mention John. She just mentioned she wanted a divorce. This crushed Isaac. He had less than a year left in his sentence and desperately wanted to salvage his marriage and keep his family together. Heartbroken and angry, he called Rose at her house. Imagine his surprise.
Oh no.
When a deep voice man answered the phone. Instantly, Isaac knew Rose was leaving him for someone else. During that phone call, John and Isaac exchanged verbal threats between each other before John just ended up hanging up the phone. He's like, I'm done. Not long after, Rose received a letter from Isaac in the mail, which stated in part, quote, I promise you, I'm going to kill him. Him being, of course, John. As the months went by, Isaac continued to threaten not only John, but also Rose from prison.
He don't give a fuck. No.
In April of 1986, Rose hired an attorney and ended up serving Isaac both divorce papers and a restraining order. This restraining order prevented Isaac from making any sort of contact with Rose, John, and even Jenny.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the records don't go into a lot of detail, but I'm pretty sure Isaac is just a dick and he's not father of the year. As I said, Isaac claimed to be heartbroken, but in reality, he was just jealous and angry. He'd actually been seeing a woman on the sly during the marriage and was still corresponding.
Oh, stop.
To one of these women.
What a fucking asshole.
I know. Oh, I'm so sad. I'm so heartbroken. Yeah. One of these women continued to correspond with him while he was in prison. Her name was Billy Fay. She was 41 years old. She was a single mom, and she worked as a medical clerk at the Kern County General Hospital. She'd met Isaac prior to his incarceration, and for whatever reason, she was attracted to him. This attraction would eventually cost her life. The two wrote romantic letters back and forth while he was in prison until his eventual release in October of 1986. When Isaac got out of prison, he moved once again with his sister and her husband, Henry, into their Bakersfield home. I remember I told you that's about 2.5 hours from Hesperia. The long distance from Bakersfield to Hesperia gave Rose and John a false sense of security and safety. But it did nothing to cool the growing obsession for revenge that was eating away at Isaac. And the restraining order did nothing to stop him from harassing the couple either. In case you thought he gave a damn, he didn't. Not long after his release, Isaac called the Montrose Avenue home and John answered the phone. Isaac demanded to speak with Rose, but John warned him that he better leave them alone. He had a shotgun and, quote, "If you come around my house, I'll blow your fucking head off."
Oh.
He means business.
Yes.
But neither John nor Rose ended up reporting Isaac for violating the restraining order, which, had they done so, may have changed the outcome of the story. Isaac's hate grew stronger and deeper, but the final tipping point occurred 1 week prior to Halloween. Isaac managed to sneak a phone call to his daughter, Jenny, without Rose and John finding out about it. And I don't know all the details, but I do know that during that call, Jenny told her dad that John and Rose were considering marriage and had discussed John adopting her.
Oh, shit.
But even more infuriating was that John said it would be okay if Jenny wanted to start calling him dad.
Oh, fuck.
He flipped a lid. That's when Isaac began developing his murderous plot for revenge. But before I tell you more, we're going to take a quick break. So Isaac is stewing. He cannot handle the amount of rage inside him. He grabbed a manila envelope and he made the following to-do list.
Oh no, he wrote it down?
Yes. Because apparently he can't remember all the things he's going to have to do to kill John and Rose. He's got to write it down. He needs to be organized.
Yeah, he doesn't want to forget anything.
And this is what his list said. Monday, call Rose. Wednesday, gather all necessities. Get spooky mask from Halloween store. Get wigs from wig shop. Call Billy Fay for dinner. Lie. Call hardware store for closing time. Get carpet, gas cans, shovels, remove plates off van, and lastly, he noted, make garrote.
Oh, God.
Shit.
How are you going to forget those?
I know. Like, you need to be reminded you need to make a garrote.
Right.
Under the title Deadlines, he wrote, rendezvous. Billy Fay by 3. Pick up Joseph at Greyhound bus station at 5. So who's Joseph?
Yes, Talia, who's Joseph?
And what does he have to do with Isaac's murderous plan?
What does he have to do with Isaac's murderous plan?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Joseph was Isaac's 15-year-old son from his first marriage. His relationship with his son was strained as a result of his alcoholism and incarceration.
Surprise!
But Isaac had arranged for Joseph to take a Greyhound bus to Bakersfield for a weekend of father-son bonding.
And we're going to murder people.
Yeah, well, he didn't tell Joseph that. At least Joseph was led to believe it was a weekend of father-son bonding. But Isaac had more sinister plans in mind for his teen son. The night before Halloween, Devil's Night, Billy Fay asked her mother to watch her two sons while she went out to dinner with Isaac. Now, Billy Fay lived with her mom, so it really wasn't a big deal. Her mom said sure. Since Isaac had neither a car nor a driver's license as a result of his high-speed chase, Billy Fay picked him up at his sister's house and drove them to whatever restaurant they ended up going to. When Billy Fay returned home a few minutes later, her mom was still awake. During a casual conversation, she mentioned something about helping Isaac out the next afternoon, but she didn't really elaborate too much. Her mom heard her mention something about Isaac needing her van to help move some of his belongings out of his sister's home. Halloween morning, Billy Fay dropped her children off at school. She ran some errands, and then she made it back to her mother's house before noon. At around 1 p.m., she told her mom she was leaving to just, quote, run some errands, and that she'd be back in plenty of time to get her sons ready to celebrate Halloween. That was the last time her mother ever saw her alive.
Oh.
Less than 2 hours later, Isaac's brother-in-law, Henry. Now, Isaac lives at Henry's house because Henry's married to Isaac's sister. He received a phone call from Isaac. Isaac claimed to be stuck without a ride at the mall and wondered if Henry wouldn't mind giving him a lift home. Henry agreed to meet him at about 3 p.m. outside the front entrance of Montgomery Ward's department store. You remember that department store?
I do.
Henry sat there for over an hour, just waiting for Isaac before giving up and going home. Now, remember, there's no cell phones to be like, hey, dude, where are you? I've been sitting here an hour. And he didn't want to just leave Isaac high and dry. But after an hour, he was like, shit, this is stupid. I'm going home.
I would have been fucking pissed.
I know. Sitting
I would have for an hour.
Wasted my time.
I know.
What Henry didn't know is that Isaac didn't need a ride. He now had a van in his possession. What Isaac needed were guns. And being that Henry was a retired cop, he had plenty of them at his house.
Aw, shit. I know I've said that about 16 times today, but aw, shit.
It's a perfect phrase for this. Isaac lured Henry away from the home with a ruse of needing a ride so he could rob Henry of his weapons. After stealing all of Henry's guns, Isaac headed to the Greyhound bus station in his newly acquired van, and he greeted 15-year-old Joseph. He threw a suitcase in the rear of the van, and Joseph hopped in. Because it was Halloween, it didn't seem odd to Joseph that Halloween masks and wigs and capes adorned the middle bench seat. He didn't even notice the footlocker, duffel bag, and rolled-up rug that covered the rear bench seat. Instead of taking Joseph to Isaac's sister and brother-in-law's house, he headed on the highway that led from Bakersfield to Hesperia. They were going to go on a 2.5-hour road trip. Sipping on scotch and pounding down beers, Isaac explained to Joseph that he had, quote, a little something to take care of concerning his wife, Rose, end quote. But he didn't elaborate on exactly what that little something was. It was roughly 7:30 p.m. when he veered off the highway and onto the Hesperia off-ramp. The two guys cruised up and down Mount Rose Avenue, with Isaac slowing down to surveil Rose and John's house. There were no lights on in the home, but Isaac knew they had to return at some point. So he parked the van on the side of the street and settled in until they did. He didn't care if he had to sit there all night. He wasn't moving until they got home. Around 9:30 p.m., a member of the Hesperia Fire Department approached the driver's side of the van. As a convicted felon on parole, he wasn't allowed to have a gun in his possession, and he certainly shouldn't be driving around with scotch and beer. He ushered Joseph to cover all the contraband up and hesitantly rolled down the window. The firefighter told him a complaint had been called in about some kids setting off firecrackers in the area. And Isaac was like, oh, no, I didn't hear. I didn't see anything. And with that, the firefighter walked away. A half hour later, Isaac spotted John and Rose driving down Montrose Avenue, and he watched them as they pulled into the garage. Joseph was commanded to put on the Halloween mask, the wig, and the black cape, as his father told him it was now time to deal with Rose. Joseph protested. He said, quote, Dad, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be involved in it. His father struck him in the head with his open hand and then threatened him with a gun, warning him that you better do what you're told to do. Isaac placed a 38 automatic pistol in a derringer. Do you know what a derringer is?
Is it a handgun?
Yeah, it's one of those really tiny ones.
Oh.
Super tiny. They're almost cute if you could have a cute gun. He had stolen them, obviously, earlier from Henry. He put those in his jacket pockets and concealed a shotgun under his long cape.
A shotgun? Damn.
A shotgun. I know he gave Joseph a gun. I don't know what type of gun it was, though. Dressed in their Halloween attire, the two exited the van, just casually walked down the street, and rang Rose and John's front doorbell. As I said earlier in the story, Rose hesitantly opened the front door and was instantly ambushed. Isaac knocked her down to the floor, and in the hysteria, his mask flew off, revealing his face filled with rage and revenge. Rose let out this blood-curdling scream in an attempt to alert John.
I'm thinking, would anyone really have noticed it being Halloween?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's Halloween. Out of all the days that you wouldn't pay attention, right, that would be the number one day. I would feel like a fool calling the police. Oh, I heard a scream.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's Halloween. But Joseph placed a gun to her head and told her to shut the fuck up or he was going to shoot her. So apparently Joseph's a quick learner. I was like, damn.
Damn, Joseph.
He knows how to follow his parents' orders.
I guess.
Hearing the sound of water coming from the master bathroom, Isaac rushed down the hallway and into the bedroom where the bathroom was located. He tried to open the bathroom door, but it was locked. In his fury, he kicked the door down. John, naked and standing in the shower, was completely caught off guard. He began screaming for Isaac to get the fuck out, get the fuck out of my house. For a brief moment, Isaac just stared at John in disbelief. He now knew John's most coveted secret. Isaac would later state, quote, I saw a person that appeared to be a man with no penis or testicles screaming at me, telling me to get the fuck out of his house, threatening me. And I had a shotgun in my hand, end quote.
What?
John had been born a female and given the birth name Catherine, but it always felt like a male on the inside. Since the age of 18, he'd been receiving large amounts of testosterone, which caused a full face beard, chest hair, and no breast development. That's what the court record said, so that's a quote. But John hadn't chosen to have gender reassignment surgery. Given the less accepting views of society towards transgenders in 1986, I don't think it's a surprise that John only told a few close friends.
I can't blame him.
I mean, plus your genitals, they're really no one else's business.
Right. Absolutely.
I mean, I don't care about your genitals. And I don't even care who you're loving on. As long as they're of age to consent and they don't walk on all fours, I don't care.
I don't either, frankly. Just mind your own business.
Before John had a chance to defend himself, Isaac raised his 12-gauge shotgun and he pointed it to John's face. In an instant, he obliterated John's being, spattering his blood and brain tissue all over the shower stall. In Isaac's mind, John had taken his life by taking his home, his wife, and his daughter away from him. So now it was John's turn to lose everything. But it wasn't enough for Isaac to just kill the man. He wanted to annihilate his existence. He fired four more shotgun blasts. And this is a 12-gauge. two into John's chest, one into his abdomen, and another one into his left arm for a total of 5 shotgun blasts.
Oh my God.
When he was done, he came back to the living room, looked into Rose's eyes, and said, quote, "Your boyfriend back there, he's gone. We blew him away," end quote. And with the butt of his shotgun, he hit Rose on the side of her head. So now the question is, what's going to happen to Rose? I don't really think Isaac had a plan for that. He and Joseph each grabbed one of Rose's arms and dragged her into the van outside. Rose resisted their efforts as they tried to force her inside the vehicle. Isaac directed Joseph to knock her out, and he obliged by punching her in the ear, and then he hit her twice in the back of her head with the gun he was holding. It didn't knock her out, it just kind of stunned her, incapacitated her for a second, and then she was thrown into the van. She ended up landing on the floor between the driver's seat and the middle bench seat. Isaac climbed into the driver's side and started the van up. Joseph hopped in the back, slammed the sliding door shut, and sat next to Rose on the floor behind the passenger seat. That 15-year-old held the gun to Rose's head and repeatedly told her to shut the fuck up. While his father was driving towards the highway, Joseph stuck his hand up Rose's blouse and began fondling her breasts from underneath her shirt.
What a little...
Why, Joseph?
I know.
Why? At this point, he still had his mask on, and Rose didn't recognize him as her 15-year-old stepson. After all, she hadn't seen him in a little over 3 years, when he was 12. Rose screamed for the masked man to stop, and Isaac warned her, if she didn't shut up, they were going to put some cuts into her. Joseph then gagged Rose. And I'm not sure what he used as a gag, but I know he gagged Rose. And then he whispered in her ear, quote, "So you like white boys, do ya?" This was a comment in regards to Rose being Hispanic and John being Caucasian. Then, without any encouragement from his father, Joseph cut off Rose's bra and repositioned her to the middle of the van so her head faced the rear and her feet pointed to the front. He tied her hands and feet with a rope and began unbuttoning her pants.
Oh, no.
He tried to pull her pants and underwear off, but realized it's really hard to do when her feet are tied. So he cut the ties, inadvertently causing a half-inch cut on one of Rose's ankles in the process. Then Joseph raped his stepmother, while his father made comments like, "Yeah, fuck that bitch." When the sexual assault was over, Isaac advised Joseph to cover her up with a blanket. Isaac drove south on Interstate 15 towards San Bernardino. Nearing Coachella, Isaac pulled off the freeway to stop at a gas station. He didn't need gas for the van. Instead, he wanted to fill up the empty gas can he placed earlier in the rear of the vehicle. Isaac slid open the side door and handed Joseph the gas can, dripping gasoline on Rose's face in the process. While the van was still parked at the gas station, Rose felt a finger being inserted into her vagina. Seconds later, Isaac pulled out of the parking lot and he continued heading down south towards Mecca. I act like I know what I'm talking about, but again, I don't. I just Google mapped it. It was shortly after midnight when a Coachella police officer named Officer Donovan noticed one of the van's headlights was out. So Isaac has a list of things to do. He's got deadlines, but at no point or time did he bother to notice he had one headlight out.
And you know it gets dark pretty early.
It gets dark at 6 p.m. as a matter of fact. I Googled the sunset.
Exactly. So it was dark before he even got to their house.
Exactly. It's so bizarre. You could get a headlight anywhere. I mean, back in the old school days, the vehicles were very easy to change headlights. Now it's all fancy
shit. I know you got to take it to the dealership to do it.
Right. You got to schedule an appointment and shit.
Right.
The officer pulled up behind the van and flashed the patrol car lights, signaling for Isaac to pull over. Isaac slowed down and he ended up parking the vehicle on the side of the interstate. And if you remember the whole melee with the high-speed chase, you know that Isaac doesn't give a fuck about the police. He's not afraid of the police. He is ready to give them hell. As Officer Donovan pulled his vehicle up a safe distance behind the van, Isaac opened the driver's side door and stepped outside. As Officer Donovan approached Isaac, he peered through a bubble window on the side of the van. As a result of Isaac's door being open, the interior light was on inside the van, and the officer thought he saw someone staring at him. Within seconds, Rose managed to free her hands and remove the gag and started yelling. At that moment, Isaac placed a gun to the back of Officer Donovan's neck and pulled the trigger.
Oh, no.
But Halloween was Officer Donovan's lucky day. He heard the click next to his ear and recognized the sound of a gun dry firing on an empty chamber.
Phew! Woo! Right?
In that moment, a gun battle ensued between the two men because you know Isaac has multiple guns. Officer Donovan managed to make it to the patrol car and radioed for backup while taking cover behind the unit. Then Joseph joined in the fight. He stepped out of the vehicle with his gun raised and started firing. Ultimately, Isaac was wounded by two bullets in the leg, but neither Officer Donovan nor Joseph was hit during the exchange of fire. Backup arrived and arrested both Isaac and Joseph. Rose had managed to survive her Halloween night of hell, but that's not the end of the story. After a cursory search of the interior of the van, the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department had it towed to a storage facility. Now, Isaac was admitted into the JFK Memorial Hospital for his gunshot wounds to the leg. The next morning, while he was getting x-rays taken, a Coachella police detective named Pete Yanis entered the room. Isaac knew Pete from his years as a firefighter. Detective Yanis, who was wearing civilian clothes, informed Isaac that he was just there to administer a gun residue kit. Isaac replied, quote, "Oh God, oh God, I didn't mean to kill both of them. Oh, what did I do? Did I kill them? Tell the officer I'm sorry. Tell him I'm so sorry," end quote. At this point, Detective Yanis was only aware of a shootout, not any murders. He didn't know anything about anything except he was supposed to just do a gun residue test. So Isaac's ramblings didn't really mean that much to him. And I can understand, after hearing Isaac's ramblings, that he was probably completely shit-faced the night before. Maybe Isaac thought he killed Officer Donovan. That's what I think Detective Yanis thought. It wasn't until 3 days later that the police realized that the van Isaac was driving didn't belong to Isaac and was, in fact, the van of a woman who was reported missing on Halloween night, Billie Faye Jones. That's when a detective named Detective Stroop was sent to the storage facility where the van was being stored to do a more thorough search of it. As he approached the door to the storage unit, Detective Stroop could already smell a strong odor of decomposing flesh emanating from inside the unit. That's pretty nasty.
That is pretty nasty.
As he pulled up the storage unit's doors, light reflected off what appeared to be brown, bloody fluids seeping from the van.
Gross.
A puddle had formed underneath the vehicle. And you have to give Detective Stroop credit. When he slid open that van's door, he knew he was going to be confronted with a horrible scene, but he had a job to do. The smell was nauseating. Had Detective Stroop known in advance what he was going to be dealing with, he maybe could have been better prepared. On the rear bench seat was a footlocker, and a duffel bag was next to it. After removing both the items, Detective Stroop found the source of the putrid smell. In a rolled-up rug that had been placed behind the duffel bag and footlocker, between them and the rear bench seat, lay the body of 41-year-old Billy Faye Jones in the advanced state of decomposition. Tied around her neck was a ligature garrote with two wooden dowlings at the ends. The wooden handles of the garrote were behind Billy Faye's neck, indicating that she had been strangled from behind. It was during the second search of the vehicle inside a suitcase that investigators found that to-do list, which included making a garrote and reminding Isaac to lie, because he needed to be reminded of that.
My favorite item on that to-do list, lie.
Like, what?
Really?
Isaac denied killing Billy Faye Jones.
Of course he did.
According to him, and I even hate having to say it, but I guess to make a complete story, I need to say what he claims happened. But it's just so dumb. I'm embarrassed to tell you what he said. According to him, he and Billy Faye met up on Devil's Night at the Rancho Bakersfield Motel, and they tried to score some cocaine, but they weren't successful. Billy Faye confided to him that she owed a large amount of money to a drug dealer, and she was afraid for her life. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
She asked him to make a garrote for her because, quote, she thought she might need it later on down the line. Like she was going to use it as a weapon against a drug dealer?
Yeah. Okay.
He gave her $500 to give to the drug dealer to spare her her life, buy her some time. In return, she gave him some crystal meth. He claims he spent the night alone at the Rancho Bakersfield Motel drinking and doing the crystal meth. He spoke to Billy Faye on the morning of Halloween, and she seemed, quote, just fine. However, later that afternoon, he spotted her van in the parking lot of the motel. He approached the vehicle and saw that the driver's door was open and the keys were in the ignition. He sat down in the vehicle. He looked into the back and saw Billy Faye's body with a garrote tied around her neck.
Oh, shit.
He panicked and he was afraid that the police would blame him.
Of course. Yes.
So he just rolled her up in a rug and kept her there.
So stupid.
Isn't that the stupidest thing?
The dumbest story.
He should have just kept his mouth shut. I mean, really. God.
Yeah. Prove I did it.
Exactly. Not make up some stupid, dumbass shit. Both Joseph and Isaac were tried for murder, with Joseph's trial commencing first in 1987. So what happens to Joseph? Isaac testified at the trial that Joseph was forced to participate in the horrifying events of Halloween, and at no point was he ever a willing accomplice. A psych evaluation of Joseph concluded that he was, quote, a nonviolent child who would normally never commit such heinous acts had he not been influenced by his father, though he did appear to succumb to the duress rather easily.
Yeah, he did.
End quote. I know. He's like, when in Rome, act as the Romans. I mean, what the hell, Joseph?
Yeah, Dad, I don't want to do this. Okay, you're going to do it. Okay.
All right. I can tell you both the judge and Rose weren't buying that he was a victim too. Regardless of how it started off, at some point, Joseph's mentality changed. Rose noted that he began fondling her breasts without any encouragement from his father. He raped her, and he also joined in the police shootout on his own accord. In the end, Joseph was sentenced to 5 to 9 years in the California Youth Authority for his involvement in the crimes. And I'm going to let everybody know Joseph isn't his real name. For some reason, the court records use that. I did happen to locate his juvenile appeal. I'm not going to say his name, but it's not Joseph. And it's not hard to figure out.
Hint, hint.
So now let's talk about Isaac. Prior to his trial, Isaac recanted all the statements he made about his son being forced to participate in the rape and the murders.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. He said that his son...
It was all Joseph's idea.
He didn't go that far, but he said that he didn't force him to do anything. He said he didn't hit him. He didn't point a gun at him. He didn't threaten him. Now, although Isaac did admit to killing John, he decided to take the case to trial. In September of 1990, Isaac was found guilty of the premeditated murder of Billy Faye Jones and John Stopher, the kidnapping of Rose, aiding and abetting the rape of Rose, and the attempted murder of Officer Dunavant. Now a jury was left to decide if he should pay for those crimes with his life. And I'm going to tell you what happens next, and you're going to tell me what you think about it, because to me, this is absolutely ridiculous. To help argue that his life should be spared, Isaac hired an expert, an anthropologist.
An anthropologist?
His name was Michael Winkleman. He specialized in cross-cultural relations between Hispanic and Anglo-Americans.
Okay.
I just want to reiterate, this is not my opinion. This is a direct quote from the records. Okay. Mr. Winkleman testified that the Mexican-American subculture in the United States is characterized by an extreme emphasis on the importance of the extended family and protecting the family's honor. According to Mr. Winkleman, defense of the family's honor might require a man to take aggressive or even violent action, and such acts would be viewed as honorable regardless of how they were viewed under the law. Mr. Winkleman testified that the Mexican-American subculture views homosexuality in the lowest of terms. Lesbianism is particularly abhorrent, and divorce was simply unacceptable. He further stated he would expect a response of outrage from an imprisoned Mexican-American male who learns his wife is involved in a lesbian relationship and is divorcing him. He was arguing, and he does say this in his defense, that he was just going to talk to John.
Uh-huh, sure.
And he brought a shotgun because John had said he had a shotgun.
Yeah, just for shits and giggles.
And it was only when he realized that John had female genitalia that he became enraged and had to honor his family or whatever and kill John.
That's such bullshit.
I know, it's embarrassing. It's just stupid. Isaac also argued he was drunk at the time of the murders and he had brain damage as a result of alcoholism.
Stop it. Fuck off. You know, this is so dumb. I guess you got to come up with something.
You got to come up with something.
You got to be creative occasionally, right?
He's trying to spare his life.
Right.
But the jury didn't care and they sentenced him to death. On December 7th in 2008, at the age of 64, Isaac died of natural causes while on San Quentin's death row. And that's my story of the Halloween of Hell in Hesperia.
Wow, that was awful.
Poor John.
Poor Rose. Poor Rose. Poor Jenny. I mean, Jenny's got to deal with this shit, too. She's only a little girl.
Her dad's crazy as all hell.
Exactly.
Bat shit. Nuts.
Wow.
Okay. I'd like to thank all of you guys for taking the time to listen to this Halloween episode. If you haven't done so already, please hit the subscribe/follow button on your favorite app that you're probably listening to. Also, check out our Apple podcast channel if you haven't already and you have Apple. We have over 100 exclusive episodes that you can get access to if you subscribe. We also have a Patreon page. It's patreon.com/TNTCrimes. If you become a Patreon, you also get access to the same exclusive episodes. And so you guys know, we release them weekly, the exclusive ones. We also do early releases of the public episodes. We also go live every 2 weeks, and we do mini episodes, alternate weeks. Right?
Yeah.
You can find out more information by going to our website, crimesandconsequences.com, or you can go to our social media. We have a Facebook and Instagram at Hardcore True Crime, and help support us by purchasing some of our merchandise. There's more information regarding that on our website, Crimes and Consequences, too. Anything else?
Nope. You covered it all.
Oh, good.
Good job, Talia.
Well, I hope everybody has a great Halloween. I don't know if they have Halloween in Australia.
I think they do celebrate Halloween in other countries.
Yeah, they have different names for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let us know, guys. Reach out to us. Let us know.
Yeah, let us know what you're going to be for Halloween. I'd love to know.
Yeah. And what they call it in your country.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you, Talia.
Don't kill each other.
Until our next episode.
Bye.
Bye.